No, just front side. Just one side. Welcome to a new class, The Tabernacle in the Temple. It's a new subject. And we're going to spend the next 3 months on this topic. And you might think, well, where are you going to find enough material to last for 3 months? Actually, we'll have trouble crowding it all into 3 months if you see where we're going. And let's take a minute to look down this schedule. We're going to talk about today about what the tabernacle is and how it applies really to us and what sorts of things we're going to be looking for as we go through this class. The tabernacle was the worship center for Israel. You know that. Most of you know that. And so we're interested. It's kind of curious the way the Bible's organized in Exodus. The construction of the tabernacle is outlined in detail to Moses, and then it's repeated again as the men put this structure together. Almost verbatim, the same instructions are given a second time. When God repeats things, usually it's because they're important. And so you might look at this and say, well, yeah, it's just a building. But there's some things about it that we're going to ferret out of the story that I think you will find interesting as well as informative and helpful as we build a temple. Did you know that we have to build a temple too? And where is that temple? It's not in Salt Lake City. It's not where. It's inside, isn't it? God dwells within each of us, and we'll talk about that at the end of our class today. So look down this list. 13 weeks. We're going to spend the first three lessons talking about how they built the tabernacle and how it was constructed. You men are going to like this because it's an engineering project, really. We're going to look at the nuts and bolts and how they put it all together. And the uniqueness of it was it was a building that could be quickly dismantled and moved away. You know, we build a building, and when we decide to move it, the way things are in this day and age, it's a huge project to pick the thing up and put it on another lot somewhere. But this one was built in such a way that it could be quickly dismantled and reassembled somewhere else. So that's really kind of interesting to see how they did that. So next week we'll look at that. The third week we're going to look at everything that was in it and the meaning of all of that. And so we have 3 weeks talking about the putting together of the tabernacle. Then we're going to talk about how it was moved, where it went, and on the 27th of June. And as you look down your list, you'll see that the Ark of the Covenant was lost and recovered by Israel in a very interesting story there. And we can lose our temple, I think, sometimes, and lose the God's dwelling within our temple. He can get up and leave. And David then and his interaction with the priests as he tried to get things reorganized and make Jerusalem his capital city. And so there were some problems that he had with that. And so they decided to build, instead of the tabernacle, to build a permanent structure, one that couldn't be moved. And that we call the temple. So the two structures, the tabernacle and the temple, we're really talking about the same kind of thing in two different situations. And so it was Solomon who built the first temple, and it relates to the tabernacle. We'll talk about that. And then that temple was destroyed by the Babylonians, and then as you see the last several lessons that we have in the series, Ezekiel describes, gives them the blueprints for replacing the temple with the second temple. And then in the time of Jesus, there was yet a third or a fourth temple that King Herod had built, Herod's temple. And so these are all interesting things that all have lessons in them for us. And so we're going to try to work that out. And it's a very visual kind of a class. But we're going to spend some lessons looking specifically at Scripture, and others we're going to look mostly at pictures. So I think you'll find it interesting. There's something for everybody. Finally, we're going to look at the ultimate temple. And that's the one to which I alluded a moment ago. That's the one in our hearts where God dwells now. It's always been God's intention to dwell with His people. But there's one thing stood in the way. Do you know what it was? What keeps God from dwelling with us? Sin. Sin creates a real problem. And that had to be overcome. And of course, that's a big issue in the entire Bible. And how does God accomplish that? And how is it that He can dwell within us? And it relates to the series of lessons that we've had from Ken over the last couple of months about righteousness. Righteousness has to be imputed to us so that God can dwell within us. So all of these stories are interrelated. Obviously, the whole Bible is interrelated, but we're looking at the same kind of question that Ken has been talking about, but from a different perspective. Okay, so let's look at where we are in the beginning. This first lesson is kind of a summary. I'm going to use the old formula of the preachers of the past, where they said, when you deliver a sermon, you tell them what you're going to tell them, then you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. And maybe by the third time, people begin to get a little bit of it. So we're going to do that, although we're going to scatter it out over 3 months. So today is tell them what we're going to tell. A description of the tabernacle. What is a tabernacle? That's kind of an interesting question. There's a verse in the 11th chapter of Hebrews. I'm going to assume that Paul wrote Hebrews, although that's not a hard and fast conclusion by many people, but it sounds like Paul. And so when I say Paul said such and such in Hebrews, you understand that I'm assuming that he wrote it. By faith, Abraham, this is the 11th chapter of Hebrews, verses 8 to 10. And we'll look at these verses in detail today because you haven't had a chance to read them before you came to class. But in coming weeks, I hope you will make that effort to read them ahead of time. By faith, Abraham, talking about people who were faithful. When called to go to a place to later receive as his inheritance, he obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. And that took a lot of faith. We've talked about that many times. This is the sentence that's particularly important to us. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents. Tents. That's the key word here. As did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. The word tents in the Hebrew is a word that's related to the idea of animal skins. They made tents out of a variety of materials. And some included animal skins, as did the tabernacle in its construction. And the word for tents often is translated, particularly in the King James Bible, as tabernacle. So it's a word, a synonym for a tent, a tabernacle. There are verses throughout the Bible that refer to this. If the tabernacle of this life is dissolved, we know that we have a dwelling made by God, eternal in the heavens. You remember verses like that. And so it's, in some translations, tabernacle. The word tabernacle, however, comes from the Latin. And it has kind of an interesting history because the idea is related to the word tavern. A tavern to the medieval world was simply a dwelling place. It came to mean something else, didn't it? As we change the meanings of words, sometimes they take on connotations that we didn't intend. But the idea of tavern or tabernacle is that it was a dwelling, simply a house or a dwelling place. By faith, Abraham made his home in tents. He lived in tents. Why did he live in a tent? Well, he moved around a lot. He didn't build a house, did he? He was going from place to place, so he's going to live in a movable structure, a tent. But think about this. By faith, Abraham made his home in like a stranger in a foreign country. What about God? God's going to come and make his home among the Israelites. And he's going to dwell in a tent, and they're going to move the thing around. He promises to dwell there. That's kind of an interesting thing that Solomon asked the question, can God really dwell in a house that we can build or a temple or a tent? Well, God's bigger than that. But in some sense, he dwelt in the tabernacle. So as we go along, we'll see that. But he was treated like a stranger, wasn't he? It was very difficult for God to live among the Israelites because of their sin. And so this verse kind of has a double meaning. It was tough going for God to dwell among the Israelites because they just really wouldn't obey him in many instances. And we talked about that in the sermon this morning that Ken gave us. But he lived in a movable construction, a tabernacle. So Paul, as I pointed out, I'm assuming that Paul is the writer here. We don't know that for sure. Paul describes this in a very interesting passage in the 9th chapter of Hebrews. In fact, the book of Hebrews has a lot of things in it about the tabernacle and the worship of the Israelites, and we'll refer to some of those as we go along. The first covenant, he's talking about the covenant that God made with Israel. It had regulations for worship and also an earthly sanctuary. Now, there's another word. What's a sanctuary? Well, the word is related to the word sanctified. What does that mean? Set apart. And a sanctuary is a place set apart, isn't it? A place designated for a specific purpose. And so they had an earthly sanctuary. Is our church a sanctuary? I hear that used sometimes. You think it is or not? I'm talking about the building. We're talking about a building here. It's set apart in a sense, isn't it, for a purpose, but it's not sanctified in the sense that the tabernacle was. And so this is simply an assembly hall, really. And we don't treat this building as though it were a special place in that sense that they're talking about there, because God doesn't dwell in this building. We've already said he dwells where? Inside of us. And the church isn't the building. The church is the people. So we have to draw a slight distinction there and keep that in mind. There's a question here. Okay. That's right. Okay, it's a safe, a refuge. Yeah, right. That's a good thought. And so it was treated that way, incidentally. People felt if they could escape to the tabernacle, somehow they were safe. And there were kings who went right in and drug them away from the altar and killed them anyway. So there was a special sense. A tabernacle was set up, Paul says. In its first room were the lampstand, the table, and the consecrated bread. This was called the holy place. Behind the second curtain was a room called the most holy place, which had the golden altar of incense and the gold-covered Ark of the Covenant. Now, that's the Ark of the Covenant is really the central item in the tabernacle. We'll talk a whole lot about that in coming weeks. This Ark contained the the gold jar of manna, Aaron's rod that had budded, and the stone tablets of the covenant. Above the ark were the cherubim of the glory, overshadowing the place of atonement. And then Paul says something that I wish he hadn't said, but we cannot discuss these things in detail now. Wouldn't it have been wonderful if he had taken another paragraph and spent a little bit of time talking about these things? That would have solved our problem probably, but now we've got to spend 3 months talking about these things. So, because he didn't spend time talking about it. Okay, so we are going to look at it in detail, and he's described in a rather succinct way what the tabernacle consists of. And it really doesn't have very many parts. It's two rooms. It's got a lampstand. It's got a table that contains some bread. It's got a incense altar. And then back in what we would call the inner sanctuary, the innermost room, is where the Ark of the Covenant was. So you can diagram that this way. And you may even have diagrams like that in your Bible. And that's what it looked like in terms of the rooms. Now, outside of the tabernacle was a basin where the priests washed before they went into the holy place, which is the larger of the two rooms. And there's an altar where they burned the corpses of the sacrifices that were offered to God. And so that altar is a major thing for the Israelites. That's where they made their sacrifices. And it's a pretty good sized structure. It's 4 cubits square, and a cubit is a little more than a foot and a half. So it's about, 6 feet in each direction? And so that's where all of the bodies of the lambs and the goats and the sheep and the cows, the rams, I was trying to think of that word. That's where all of that ended up. And so it was a place of sacrifice. The priests went into, who were the priests, incidentally? The priests were the Levites. We kind of review that. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the priests in general, except that they had a place as interposed between Israel and God. And so they represented Israel before God, and one of the men was called the high priest, and they were all descendants of Aaron. So the priests washed in the basin, went into the holy place to do their routine work, which was to maintain the lamps, keep oil in the lamps, keep the fires burning in the lamps so that there would be light in the holy place, to change out the bread, which was the bread of the presence. There was a loaf of bread, not as we think of loaves, but more like what we think of pancakes. Unleavened bread stacked on that table, 12 loaves, one representing each of the tribes of Israel. And that was replaced every week with fresh bread. There was an altar of incense. And Paul said it was in the most holy place, but it's resided usually in the holy place. Twice a day they were instructed in the morning and again in the evening to burn incense on that altar. It was used for nothing else. And it was carried into the most holy place on one day of the year when the high priest went in to make atonement for the sins of Israel. And they moved that incense altar into the most holy place, the inner room, where the Ark of the Covenant was, and burned incense before and filled the place with the smoke of the incense before the high priest went in to offer a blood sacrifice for the sins of the nation. In that inner sanctuary was the Ark of the Covenant. And God gives detailed information about how to build that. It's carried on two long poles that you see there, running horizontally on either side of it. It's not a very big box, actually. It's 31 by 52 inches, but it's gold-plated, contains a solid gold cover and two cherubim at the ends of the cover looking down into the, as though they're looking down into the cover or into the ark. And no one ever laid eyes on that. It was in a dark room, and it was not available for anybody to see. And in fact, instructions we'll see later on, if you looked at it, when they moved all of this, they had to cover the ark with a cloth to make it so that no one could cast their eyes upon it. If they looked at it, just looking at it would be enough that they would be killed. And we'll see instances where people saw it, and apparently that's what happened to them. But normally when it was carried, it was covered so that no one could see it. In fact, all of these things, these holy objects within the tabernacle were normally covered when they were transported so that people would not be harmed by them. And you know the kinds of stories that have been written about the Ark of the Covenant, and probably the most famous movie in that regard is what? Search for the Lost Ark. Yeah, the action-packed story about that. And it was a very dangerous object. It was depicted that way, wasn't it? And where is the Ark now? In some labyrinth where the government has buried all of its... No, it's not there. No, in fact, the Ark of the Covenant disappeared at the time of Babylonian captivity a long time ago. And you'll read stories about it, and you'll see things on TV where people are looking for it. I will be surprised if they find it. Now, all of this has meaning. Incidentally, this thing faces east. I put the north mark on there so that you could see. It was always set up facing east, the rising sun. I don't know exactly the significance of that. It was placed in the middle of the camp, and all of the other tents of the people, 2 million people or so, were actually 600,000 or more families. Their tents were placed around this tent in a specific order. They were told where the different tribes were to erect their tents in relation to the tabernacle. All right, now, there are several models of the tabernacle. This one is in Israel. If you take a trip to Israel, there is a display of the tabernacle. You'll have to look at that website. I'll try to give you more information about that. We're going to put the pictures and the audio of this class on the website so you can look it up. This particular website has a lot of pictures of the components of the tabernacle and the way it looked. And the Israelites set one up out on a desert site. And you can see the laver where the priest would wash himself before he goes in through those curtains into the holy place. Now, you see it's covered with a covering. And so what we normally look at are the walls of the structure that outline the rooms, but actually it has this covering which slopes down on the sides. Probably the space around the tabernacle was used for storage. Lots of instruments involved in making the sacrifices, and the priests kept clothing and stuff. So there were places to store things, and we suspect that was the case. We aren't instructed about it. But when they changed and made the temple on the model of the tabernacle, they put storage rooms all around the outside of the temple. So we suspect that's where storage was done. The altar is off to the left. It isn't in this particular picture. But you get an idea of the structure of it. It's more than just the rooms. It's got this tent, which makes it a tabernacle, over the top of it. Now, my family and I visited our daughter in Maryland, and she took us up to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And there is a model of the tabernacle set up there by the Mennonites Amish. The Amish and the Mennonites are quite similar religious groups in that particular part of the world, and they have purchased a tabernacle and set it up in a building there, and you can take a tour for about $10, and they have someone explain all of this to you and show you all of the different parts of it. And it's a very good and very solidly Bible-based presentation of the tabernacle. So if you get a chance in that region of the country, you might stop by and see it. The story's kind of interesting that that tabernacle was first built by a Baptist preacher in Florida. And as he grew older, the people came to see, they flocked to see the tabernacle. I don't remember what city it was in. But as he grew older and wasn't able to keep up with it, he looked at the list of people who were coming and found that the Mennonites were the most frequent group to come and see the tabernacle, which he had made. And so he offered to sell it to them, and they purchased it and carried it off to Pennsylvania and rebuilt it there. But it is a very interesting thing to go see, and it's helpful for your children to see it, I think. Now, if you strip away the tent and look at just the structure, we're going to talk some next week about all of the different parts and how this thing is assembled. This is the basic wood-based structure of the tabernacle, and it's gold-plated. And it has colored curtains and that sort of thing in it. And so we'll talk in detail about that next week. But keep in mind when you see this, which defines the two rooms, the large room towards you and the model and the inner room at the very back. This thing, you have to picture it covered by the tent. And the tent, quite a bit of information was given you about the tent, and we're going to discuss that next week. And how the thing could be taken apart, that's the main thing. Now, this is a model that the Mennonites sold, which I purchased and built it. I used to build model airplanes, so I really got back into, it was like going back in time, putting a model together again and painting it and all that kind of stuff. This model is on display in front of our library. If you go over in this other building and go to the second floor before you go into the library, there's a table there that has the tabernacle model on it. So you can take a look at that. Did we get the top lid of that thing? No, not yet. So please don't write in the sand on the floor. The kids are prone to do that, but anyway. But because it can be dismantled, it comes apart pretty easy, so you have to handle it carefully. Okay, and we'll talk about that in detail. Now, here's what I showed you a while ago. A lot of commentaries and preachers and writers have pointed out that this model has some interesting analogs in our world. And so they say, each of these components has a New Testament application. If you consider the altar, that would be where Jesus was sacrificed. Outside of the tabernacle was a fence made out of curtains, which completely encircled this and kept the world out. Only the Israelites could go in, and only the priests could go into the holy place. And so, as you come from the world, you encounter the sacrifice of Jesus. you're washed in the waters of the bath, the baptism. And then the priest can go into the holy place. But all Christians are priests. That's told us several times in the New Testament. And so as Christians, having obeyed the gospel, having been baptized, we are then part of the people who can enter the holy place. And we have access through that first curtain into this outer room, which corresponds to the church. And it contains the lamps. And the lamps always represent what? Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my way. And so the lamp represents the word of God. The table of the presence, representing with loaves of bread, which represent the tribes of Israel, always present before the throne of God. That corresponds to our communion with God. And so there's another correlation. And you'll find as we look at these things, specifically next week, we're going to look at each of these things in detail. The altar of incense, and the incense particularly represents, in a number of places in the Bible, represents prayer. And then the inner sanctum, the most holy place, contains the throne of God. And so that represents heaven. Now, God came down to earth and told Moses to build this structure specifically according to the pattern that I showed you in the mount. He gives him a blueprint. Do not deviate from the blueprint, and there must be a reason for that. And so you see the correlation here. When Jesus died, he went through that second curtain, and it said it was split from top to bottom and gives us access to who? To the throne of God. And so we don't go into the throne of God in this life, but by prayer we have access to Him. He instructs us through the Word, which is represented by the lamps, and it's kind of interesting to wonder, why are there seven of them? And so we'll look at that next week. 12 tribes of Israel, that even that may still be valid, and that all of us are part of the tribes of Israel. Okay, Sam? Right. To the throne of God. So as priests, we can talk to God. And you see, we have prerogatives that the world doesn't have. So we're going to talk about all of this because we have to consider the fact that we're building a temple for God's habitation within us, within our heart. All right, now I want to spend just a few minutes looking at the remaining scriptures here because they set the stage for the material we're going to look at next week. The Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to bring me an offering. You're to receive the offering from me, from each man whose heart prompts him to give. These are the offerings you're to receive from them: gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, fine linen, goat hair, ram skins dyed red. That sounds very specific, doesn't it? And the hides of sea cows. We're not sure if it was sea cows or manatees or dolphins are exactly what? Something that grows in the Red Sea, presumably. Acacia wood, olive oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil for the priests, and for fragrant incense, and onyx stones and other gems to be mounted in the ephod and the breastpiece. That was for the high priest. Then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them. You see, there's the promise that God will dwell among Israel if they will make a sanctuary, make him a dwelling place, make him a tabernacle. So those terms are used interchangeably. Make this tabernacle and all its furnishings exactly like the pattern I will show you. All right? And Paul makes a big point of that in the book of Hebrews. So, now, after Moses was told that, lots of things happened. We're skipping over here because Israel, when Moses went back up on the mountain for 40 days, Israel sinned with the golden calf. There was an exchange in which God almost wiped them out. But by Moses' intercession, they were saved, although many of them who had participated in the revelry died. Now we get to chapter 35 and things have settled down and God has come back to his instructions about building the tabernacle. So here's the story. They get this information which God had told Moses to deliver to them. The whole Israelite community withdrew from Moses' presence, and everyone who was willing, whose heart moved him, came and brought an offering to the Lord for the work on the tent of meeting, for all its service and for its sacred garments. Let's stop and ask a question here. What percentage of the Israelite community do you suppose this included? Suppose everybody's heart was moved to deliver their sacrifice to Moses, or some small fraction of them. If it's like the modern world, 20% of the congregation does 80% of the work or something like that. I don't know what the actual numbers are these days. I suspect not everybody participated. Who did participate? Everyone who was willing, first place, and heart moved him. You know, you might be willing and your heart not moved you to do anything. You say to yourself, well, I probably should participate in the Vacation Bible School. I'm willing to do that, but of course I got a lot of other distractions and responsibilities, and I don't guess I will. Your heart has to move you to make an acceptable offering to God. All right, all who were willing, men and women alike, not just men, came and brought gold, jewelry of all kinds. Now, they had borrowed all of this stuff from the Egyptians when they left Egypt several months before. All kinds of brooches. You know what a brooch is? I don't know what a brooch is, but I know my grandmother had brooches, okay? It's some sort of jewelry that you fasten to your garments. And earrings, rings, and ornaments. They all presented their gold as a wave offering to the Lord. Now, a wave offering is they in effect, transmit its ownership to God. Everyone who had blue, purple, or scarlet yarn, or fine linen, or goat hair, ram skins, dyed red, or hides of sea cows, brought them. Those last two items are for the outer coverings of the tabernacle tent. Those presenting an offering of silver or bronze brought it as an offering to the Lord. Now, they're not giving this to Moses. And when you put money in the collection plate on Sunday, you're not giving it to Ken. And you're not giving it to the elders. You're giving it to God. Offering to the Lord. And everyone who had acacia wood for any part of the work brought it. It's kind of interesting about acacia. It's a scrub brush that grows in the land over there now, and you wonder, well, how would they ever make anything out of that? It's sort of like what's the scrub we have in West Texas out there? Mesquite. But you know, if you get a pretty good-sized mesquite tree, the grain and the wood is kind of interesting. So the suspicion is that the ecology was such that there was a lot more moisture and the trees grew much bigger than they do now. Every skilled woman spun with her hands and brought what she had spun, blue, purple, or scarlet yarn, or fine linen. And all the women who were willing and had the skill spun the goat hair. Now, they contributed the hair, but someone had to assemble it into cloth, didn't it? The leaders brought onyx stones and other gems to be mounted on the ephod and breastplate piece. They also brought spices and olive oil for the light and for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense. All the Israelite men and women who were willing brought to the Lord free will offerings. What's a free will offering? Well, it means you didn't get paid for it, you see. And so it's given freely, free will offerings for the work the Lord through Moses had commanded them to do. And later on, and then Moses said to the Israelites, "See, the Lord has chosen Bezalel, son of Uni, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and he has filled him with the Spirit of God, with skill, ability, and knowledge, and all kinds of crafts to make artistic designs for work in gold, silver, or bronze, to cut and set stones, to work in wood, to engage in all kinds of artistic craftsmanship." He was a jack of all trades, wasn't he? He could do all of that. And where did he get that ability? Where did you get your ability? Whatever ability you have is what God has placed within you. And you say, "Well, I got that because I went to A&M or UT or somewhere." But no, God has been in control of your life, and you've been given information from other people, but you're able to use that because God's placed that ability within you. And he has given both him and Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan, the ability to teach others. And so there is a second skill that where do you become a teacher? Well, God places that within you, and so Bezalel had an assistant there who could help him as they taught others. He's filled them with the skill to do all kinds of work as craftsmen, designers, embroiderers in blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, and fine linen, and weavers, all of them master craftsmen and designers. So your skills come from God, and you need to use them in building a temple for God. Moses summoned them, and every skilled person whom the Lord had given ability and was willing to come and do the work. They received from Moses all the offerings the Israelites had brought to carry out the work of constructing the sanctuary, and all the people continued to bring free will offerings morning and after morning. So all the skilled craftsmen who were doing all of the work on the sanctuary left their work and they just stopped. "We can't do this. Why?" And they said to Moses, "The people are bringing more than enough to do the work of the Lord commanded to be done." Then Moses gave an order, and they sent this word throughout the camp: "No man or woman is to make anything else as an offering for the sanctuary." And so the people were restrained from bringing more because what they already had was more than enough to do all the work. Wouldn't it be wonderful if this church gave so much that we had to tell everybody stop? You ever hear of that anywhere? I've never heard of it, but your elders would be pleased to deal with that problem if you're interested. Okay, one more slide. "Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit lives in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him, for God's temple is sacred, and you are that temple." We're building a temple. Throughout our life as Christians, when we're baptized, we don't automatically have an ideal dwelling place for God. He will dwell within us. He might be sleeping on a mat, and you would rather him sleep on a mattress. I don't know for comparison. But you've got a lifetime to make that habitation for God more acceptable to him. And so we need to be applying ourselves to making our hearts agreeable to God, in such a way that he can dwell within us effectively. That's what we're going to work on throughout this course of study, and that's the ultimate application of it. Okay, our time is gone. Thank you very much. I appreciate your close attention.